So lecture 18, October 23rd, 2023. Lecture notes page is 150. Here we are, coming up towards the end of October. Exciting time for everyone. what do we know here? We know that mini test 8 closed last night. The average score, as you can see, is settled around 90%, so that's where it's been. 9 will open tomorrow on the regular schedule, and it will close Sunday, October 29th. On its regular schedule. We know that enhanced learning extra credit number, I don't know if I knew it last time or not, but AL5, the average is 0.26. So overall, you've added 1.3% to your final course grade on average. Good for you. And the next one is open until Wednesday evening. So we talked a little bit about global marketing, and periodically we think about it from the US side, domestic. Market is going global, and sometimes we think about it from the other side, people going global from their perspective. Chinese electric vehicle suppliers plan side doors into the U.S. market. Chinese battery companies critical to electric vehicles are pursuing deals with U.S. free trade partners, South Korea and Morocco, seeking to tap growing demand in America and bypass rules that are aimed at shutting them out of the market. So we're seeing global business foreign market entry strategy from their perspective, global partnerships, and they are working against intense domestic competition, looking for other outlets for their products. Chinese businesses that supply raw materials to make EV batteries have announced at least 9 joint ventures and investments worth more than $4.5 billion in South Korea this year, and at least 4 Chinese firms said they plan to build plants in Morocco. Producing battery-related products. So global business, we talked about it from our perspective, but via joint ventures and with direct investment. By working out of the two countries, the Chinese suppliers hope to supply car and battery makers who are eligible for incentives doled out by the $430 billion Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA. So they're part of the global supply chain. The new law, the IRA, shuts out battery content and critical materials from so-called foreign entities of concern, a provision targeted at minimizing China's involvement in America's EV supply chain. So we're seeing the impact of regulatory, legal, political factors on business. On the other hand, some of the stuff they do in terms of the raw materials they provide and the technology they bring to the table, nobody else is doing that right now. So once you shut them out, what's your plan exactly for the industry? I'm not sure of that, but I'm not a lawmaker. Chinese suppliers hope that these joint ventures would allow customers to continue sourcing from them and still access the incentives under this law, which offsets more than 1/10 the cost of an average electric vehicle. So dealing with international trade issues from their perspective. South Korea EV suppliers benefit from partnering with Chinese firms to access key materials and expertise in processing, so global partnerships at work. Analysts say one wild card is that U.S. authorities haven't yet defined exactly what constitutes a foreign entity of concern in this law. The U.S. hasn't defined what level of Chinese involvement and at what stage of the supply chain they would be acceptable for auto and battery producers in order to qualify for those tax credits. This uncertainty means there's a risk such joint ventures could ultimately be barred from receiving incentives. So when we talked about going international, from our perspective, the idea of the greater control, the more involvement you have, the riskier things get. From their perspective, they're putting a few billion dollars into these partnerships and ventures. Who knows how it's going to play out for them? So we have to think about it from both sides of the table. So there's business uncertainty and risk. Are any of you, and I don't talk to people of your age group often, I don't often talk to people of my age group, so it really doesn't mean anything. Are you, any of you guys on the sober bandwagon, not especially interested in alcoholic drinking? Is that a thing? So 1, 2, 3, 4, did I see a hand of here? 4 or 5? So apparently this is a big new trend among your generation. My generation are much alcoholics, but you people seem to see some other things going on. So this brand says, drink it like you mean it, but with a little twist on that. People who rage late into the night aren't usually the ones to rise early the next morning. And those who drink themselves silly aren't often thinking about their health. But a campaign from an alcohol alternative called Free Spirits says that those diametrically opposed actions can, in fact, go together. In its most significant marketing push to date, the young San Francisco-based brand debuts a long-form commercial with a provocative tagline, "Drink it like you mean it. So that's your ad message, and of course they're trying to get attention. See what you think and if this sends the message to you.
Too often in life, we bend to the wills of others, of established expectations. We succumb to peer pressure. We follow the cues of industry or society at large. But I'm here to remind you, this life is too damn short and frankly too filled with amazing experiences to live in any way other than your way. Take drinking, for example. For too long, the world has been working to convince us that alcohol needs to be the star player of a great social life, the guest of honor at every gathering, that without it, and a lot of it, we're missing out. And hey, you know what? Maybe alcohol is in the plan for the night. Maybe just a little bit, maybe a lot, maybe none. Either way, it's gotta be your choice, and it's gotta be great. So let's refuse to follow any industry or societal expectations and lead the life each of us were meant to live. Anything short of that is an insult to whoever threw us this party. So yeah, drink more cocktails and less alcohol. Rage later. Rise earlier. Drink like a rock star. Shine like a superstar. Be social or antisocial. Drink yourself silly. Drink to your health. And if someone tells you that alcohol needs to have a leading role in your life, give them the bird. Free Spirits. Drink like you mean it.
So obviously, they're poking a little fun at the industry that tells you you have to drink to have fun. They're saying, don't pay attention to those commercials that tell you how to live your life. Let's point out this is a commercial telling you how to live your life a different way, but okay. So, the phrase, drink it like you mean it, would obviously seem irresponsible if it came from big alcohol, but Free Spirits aims to grab the attention of a range of consumers, from the fully sober to the sober curious. The message, though, is to imbibe intentionally, not to overindulge. So here we see a bit about their target audience and getting attention for the brand and their brand message. The campaign, which will air digitally via paid ad and social, launches during Sober October. How many of you guys know that phrase? That was I know about January. I didn't know about Sober October. I got to stay up with the trends more. Sober October, an increasingly popular challenge where drinkers abstain for the month or some part of it. It's also time to a new Free Spirits package redesign, rolling out ahead of the busy holiday, pre-dry January. I did know that one, period. So media selection and timing. The approach may appeal to particularly to millennials and Gen Z, who are largely responsible for driving the non-alcohol trend, with Gen Z often referred to as the soberest generation. So we see marketing to a group we talked about, age cohorts, and changing consumer tastes and their influence on business and marketing. Still a nascent segment, making up less than 1% of total alcohol sales, booze-free beverages logged $510 million in sales during the 52-week period ending July 29, 2023, a 31% increase over the previous year. So small, little bit, but beginning to grow. We'll see what happens. There was a stigma for a lot of years, but it's becoming much more accepted and respected when people are drinking in a moderate way. So we're adopting our products. We're talking about product in the marketing mix, product place promotion. We're adapting our products to changes in consumer attitudes. Finally, we come up with Call of Duty players. Three people. I thought you guys did video. You guys? Maybe you're on the web, so you do. Maybe you're playing Call of Duty while you're listening. All right. Activision revives a controversial Call of Duty tagline for the 20th anniversary. There's a soldier in all of us, says the ad. The text is emblazoned over a shot of a ragtag army led by a teenage boy preparing to engage in battle. The scene is meant to be the emotional climax of Activision's new ad campaign, which is both a promotion of its latest first-person shooter game, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, and a celebration of the franchise's 20th anniversary. So here's the ad theme. The tagline was first used to promote Call of Duty Black Ops in 2010, and back then it generated controversy for what critics saw as a cavalier, even whimsical attitude towards war. What do you mean there's a soldier in all of us? So their reactions to the ad campaign. Activision's new ad reviving the tagline drops at a time of mounting global violence, I think you're aware. With the war between Israel and Hamas less than 2 weeks old, the question is raised that makers of violent video games have long struggled with, whether they risk backlash from consumers amid the trauma of real-world events. Man, it's hard to please everybody. What do consumers want? And by the way, if you're a marketer, these things are years in the planning. You're about to roll it out and say there's a world event that occurs. How do you plan for that? The tagline is meant to evoke a kind of sports analogy, being a team and entering the situation together, as well as connecting to the idea that anyone can play Call of Duty and have fun doing so. So the intended message, but what are your consumers perceiving given what's going on in the world today, yeah? If consumers make a connection to current negative experiences or world events, they might punish the brand, in essence saying, what are you doing? You're being insensitive. This campaign drops less than a week after Activision Blizzard, the parent company of Activision, was officially acquired by Microsoft for nearly $69 billion. The deal went through almost two years of regulatory battles. It was finalized after Microsoft restructured the terms to the approval of the UK's Competition and Market Authority. So growth through acquisition on the part of Microsoft, and then fighting off legal issues related to your business and marketing growth strategy. So we'll have to see. Is anybody bothered by this tagline, given, I don't know, either your attitude in general or what's going on? There's a soldier in all of us. That doesn't seem necessary. I don't like it. Yeah, it's fine. I don't care either way. Huh. All right. So perhaps that'll be the general public's reaction. We'll see. All right, on to lecture notes, page 150, chapter 10, page 288 in the textbook. We're talking about product as one of the four P's in the marketing mix, and in particular, we were focusing on the idea of new products. We ended up with a little bit of a lengthy piece of Fred Hunt talking about the development of a new product idea for Sherwin-Williams. The tagline at the bottom was this product, which is the screw top paint cans, and I don't think we got to the issue of the ad for it, but maybe we did. Anyhow, here it comes. As you can see, coming right at you. Yes, no? I can see it says control click. I am control clicking. Okay. So here's the ad for this new product that they came out with.
Find it, try it, paint it, love it.
Now there's a paint can that's as great as the paint that's in it. The original Twist and Pour paint container from Dutch Boy. Easy to hold, easy to open, easy to pour. For a neat way to paint. The original Twist and Pour paint container from Dutch Boy. Now available in quarts. For a retailer near you, visit DutchBoy.com.
Dutch Boy being a subsidiary of Sherwin-Williams. So,
now
the dealio was they went out, they did ethnographic research, they followed people around. They said mostly they followed women around because they do a lot of this painting. They asked women what they don't like about what's going on. You ever pick up a paint can and it catches on your ring or something? It's like, what do you do it? So they created this thing with a broad handle. Then, as he literally said to me when they were talking about this, he said, consumers said, what other product in my household do I need a screwdriver to get open and a hammer to close? What are you talking about? So they come up with an entirely new product with the twist-off can that solves a lot of these problems. And interestingly, it did not, you can still go to a paint store and find both kinds of cans there. So it didn't cannibalize their old paint seals, but a subsegment of the population like this new one. Anybody ever see this one or use the twist-off can? No? All right, so it's out there as part of their new product development process. So we've come up with some new ideas like that. We're going through internal evaluation of the market potential. You know, how many of these things do we think we can sell? We're going to see if it fits in with our mission and our competencies. Can we work with this? Does it make sense? What effect will it have on other products? We want to know as best we can, is it going to totally cannibalize our other paint can sales? Maybe that's not the best thing then. We're not growing, we're just stealing. Raw materials, I don't know what kind of plastic they use for that, but is that raw material available? Do they have a lot of it? As the sales grow, can they get more of it? The patent position, we would not like our competition to steal it right away. Maybe we go through some external concept tests as we screen and evaluate. I don't have the product right here, but here's what it would do. Here's what it would look like. Here's a picture of it. What do you think to help screen for it? Business analysis, we're moving along the timeline, spending more money, check against our customers' needs, establish our target market, see what the competition would look like against this new product, develop our target position, STP, segmentation target positioning, develop the initial product specs, perform an economic analysis, and then over time, you're going to have to revise, refine it as you go. If it gets through this stage, we move to stage 5 where we actually develop it, getting more expensive. We're now actually going to get involved in the supply chain process, the manufacturing process, the control systems for quality. Our marketing programs are ramping up. We're now updating our costs and our financial plans. We're making sure that our target costs can be met. A good way to fail is to have your product be way more expensive than you think it's going to be. So when you take it to market at the price point you had in mind, you're losing money. Oops, that's not a good plan. Then over to stage 5 development part 2, create a prototype. You're now actually making this product. More money, more cost, more expense. You're testing it in the lab or possibly getting consumers to try it. You're checking how the consumers react to your planned marketing mix. Let's take a look at customer use tests.
What's really cool and interesting is in-home usage tests. We call it an iHUT. So it's really powerful because instead of saying like, let's imagine you're a yogurt company or maybe you're in the toothpaste industry. Instead of saying, hey, we've got in a survey, we have a mint flavor, we have a cherry flavor, we have a strawberry flavor. What do you think sounds most appealing? Instead, these companies that we partner with are actually able to recruit their target demographic. So let's say they're looking for 30 to 54-year-olds for the toothpaste study. Once those people are screened and they qualify for that study, then we'll confirm their physical address. And actually, the company will be able to send out those products. And so then, again, this kind of goes back to the power of us owning those member data sets because they're then able to recontact them and follow up and say, okay, so you were testing that toothpaste for the last week. What did you like? What didn't you like? Did you like the flavors? Did you like, you know, how it foamed, et cetera, and actually get that real experience and feedback so that you can actually make those informed decisions. And that's been super powerful for our clients. Yeah, it's really cool. And so much to the point that I'm starting to ask, like, why don't we work with apparel companies? Like, why wouldn't an apparel company send out either images of threads or whatever, or, you know, particular pieces of clothes because they can make more informed decisions instead of like, hey, we didn't sell 1,000 shirts last year because nobody liked it.
So Protege is actually helping companies to do this real test of the real product in trial. Get feedback and revise your product as necessary, send it back out to consumers, retest it again, reevaluate it against the competition. Then depending on your industry and your situation, either you go to a full test market, stage 6, or directly to stage 7 commercialization. In stage 6, you go to a test market. Here you're going to roll out the full thing. That's a lot of money. Out to a couple different cities maybe that represent your target audience, have your target audience there. You're going to test the promotion methods. You're going to see if people come back and buy it again. You're going to see what your media mix looks like and what works best. You're going to check whether or not your channel partners accept the product. You're going to test different prices in different cities. You're going to build up product inventories, develop more distribution channels, revise as needed. Or if that won't possibly work, maybe because the competition will monkey with you, jump on it right away, hold a sale as soon as they see you're doing something special and mess you up. Maybe you do a simulated test market. And then if we succeed, one, two, stage seven, the launch, commercialization, ramp up production, ramp up purchasing for the supply chain, activate your quality focus control systems, mass train the sales force or the service personnel, have dealer meetings for the supply chain members to make sure they understand the product, run trade ads, run customer ads, have a press conference, all to get this thing successfully working out in the real world. And then I've added stage eight, not mentioned in the book, so this is an additional piece, evaluation of how things went. Yeah, that seems like it'd be important. Analyze the sales data, analyze the profit situation, revise your promotional mix, adjust your product specs, reallocate your sales force, phase out over time any weak items, and move on to continuous improvement based on the feedback and the evaluation that you get over time. Make sense? So here we are. We worked our way down the whole thing to the first of the four P's of the marketing mix, the product or service. We rolled out the marketing program. We saw the market response. We get feedback. We engage in evaluation and control back into the whole system, part of that new product development process. So you know what's going on. You're able to manage it. You're able to change it based on the consumer response. Why do new products fail? According to Harvard Business School, Professor Clayton Christensen says there's over 30,000 new products introduced every year. Holy mackerel. And he says 95% of them fail. Why? Well, one thing is the product you've come up with offers no competitive advantage over what's already out there. Let's take a look at this ad for a new television.
At Sharp, our goal is to reproduce every color in the world on TV. Introducing Quatron QuadPixel technology. It adds a fourth color, yellow, to the standard RGB color system, creating a vast array of colors you can't see with your TV's three-color technology. But you can see this. Whoa! Oh my.
Quatron from Sharp. You have to see it to see it.
Well, that's a problem. You have to see it to see it. Now, how often have you sat in front of your TV set, looked at the picture and said, man, that isn't yellow enough? And by the way, where would you see this ad for the more yellow? On your TV set. Tell me again about what the relative advantage is to this particular product as advertised. Now, of course, this company isn't stupid. They come up with later on in time with another Aquos product where you can begin to see a little bit better what it is
the they're promising. The future of TV is here. Aquos, world's first 8K resolution TV. There's nothing like it.
All right, I don't exactly know the details. They didn't spend a lot of time on it, but 8K probably is sharper and more excited than my existing screen. I believe that's a possibility. I might see that advantage. But yellow? I got enough yellow. So no competitive advantage, the product fails. Or the competitive reaction, they see what you're doing and they ramp up a product just like it, or they ramp up a cheapened version of the product, or they ramp up a sale in the place that you're trying to sell your product, so it messes with your distribution. It's badly positioned, so it's the idea of the clear Pepsi. First of all, nobody wanted it. Second of all, what was it? It's clear and it's Pepsi. I don't know what it is. Poor quality can cause products to fail pretty easily, obviously.
So the Itera plastic bicycle from 1982 was a Swedish national innovation failure. It was twice the price of a regular bicycle, it was unstable, and it broke.
Sign me up, twice the cost, plastic, and it breaks. I want something. No, I don't. I don't want any of that at all. So that's not good. Doesn't deliver on the promised benefits that the product says.
This is the Ford Edsel from 1958. It was supposedly Ford's biggest mistake. To change gears, you push buttons inside the steering wheel. So instead of tooting the horn, it goes into reverse. It was mega hyped up. It even had its own TV show. Ford's problem was that they got their customers to install this fantasy. From a psychological perspective, the fiction of the future can be much greater than reality actually is. There was no way that the car could ever meet those expectations.
So you don't meet the customer's expectations, you don't deliver on the promised benefits. Of course, too little marketing synergy. Remember, we're discovering the satisfying consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit through the integrated effort of the firm. Everything isn't pulling the same way. Consumers can't figure out what it is you're doing. That's not going to help. Low perceived value. Consumers don't feel that you're bringing them money.
I could fill an entire museum with smartphones. This is a Microsoft Kin cheap phone. Nobody liked it. The Twitter Peak, completely useless device. People already had smartphones. This is the Iridium satellite phone. Too expensive. Cell phones are cheaper and better. The Amazon Fire phone had a buy button. People hated it.
No value for that product to me. No, thank you. I don't need it. I don't want it. Bad estimates of market potential so that you don't ramp up. You ramp up too much production. Now you have too much inventory sitting around. You thought you were selling a lot more. What are you going to do? People don't want it. You got to lower the price. That doesn't make sense. Forecasts are dangerous, especially those about the future. That's a joke because all forecasts are about the future. Poor estimates of production and or marketing costs can be a problem.
What you're looking at here is a teleguide. It's sort of like a pre-internet internet. You could use it to find phone numbers. You could even do some simple shopping on it. The teleguide failed because Swedish Telecom had not negotiated good enough prices, so they actually lost money on each product that was sold.
Yeah, somebody missed those estimates. What do you mean we're going to lose product on every one we sell? That's going to be a failure. Poor selection of the marketing channels. You're not reaching your target audience, either with the media or with the product itself. Rapid changes in the marketing environment. By the time your product comes out, things have changed. Whoops, that's no good. And here's a whole series of greatest flops over time.
Hi, I'm Amy Chapman for 24/7 Wall Street, and today we're taking a look at some of the worst product flops of all time. Big companies sometimes have to take big risks and spend big bucks to find the next it product. But those attempts aren't always successful. In fact, they can sometimes be downright epic failures. To identify some of the worst product flops of all time, 24/7 Wall Street reviewed products introduced by America's largest companies from 1950 onwards. Here's a look at the worst five. At number five, it's Wow Chips. Made with the fat substitute Olestra, Wow Chips were marketed as a healthier snacking option, and public perception followed until Olestra turned out not to be the miracle ingredient consumers initially believed it to be. At number four, it's Hot Wheels and Barbie computers. As part of an attempt to reconcile the declining sales of Barbie dolls and growing sales of software and CD-ROMs, Mattel joined forces with Patriot Computers, but manufacturing flaws were ultimately their undoing. At number three, it's Easy Squirt Ketchup. Heinz added a little color to its game with this range of differently colored ketchup and matching squeeze bottles aimed at youngsters, who ate it up, but for less than 6 years. At number two, it's the touchpad. Hewlett-Packard's answer to Apple's iPad was unveiled with an extremely costly, celebrity-filled advertising campaign. Sales, however, didn't come close to matching the roughly $15 billion marketing budget. And at number one, it's Google Glass. Google Glass was introduced on the principle that technology should be there when you need it and get out of your way when you don't. After 2 years of disappointing sales, it was clear that consumers did not need Google Glass. And there you have it, the five worst product flops of all time.
And each of those cost those companies a few bucks. Do you guys remember when Google Glass, is that something in your memory, that it was going to be the next big thing? Yeah, well, they're convinced it's going to be just what you need as soon as they figure it out. So they're going through that cycle we talk about. create it, market it, evaluate it, change it. We'll see if it's something you need or not over time. So research, research, research to try to get these new product ideas out there in a way that satisfies consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm. So congratulations, you have a series of product lines out there. You're in business. You did the research. That takes us to the next part of product, and that's the idea of managing products and brands, chapter 11, perhaps lecture notes page 158 or thereabouts. So we're going to try to manage our products and brands. I like the Starbucks example, so I get a little over-enthused. This goes on a little bit longish, but it still talks about an excellent brand and how it's been managed over time. Starbucks fans, I forget. We have started? Okay, so maybe it'll be interesting. So in the early years, the first Starbucks was opened in Seattle, Washington, on March 30th, 1971. Their goal was to sell high-quality coffee beans, the beans, for people to use in making coffee at home. In 1982, Howard Schultz, the new director of retail operations and marketing for the company, took a trip over to Italy, to Milan. On his return, he advised that the company should sell coffee and espresso in addition to the whole bean, leaf, teas, and spices that they had been offering. Because he saw how it worked in Italy, he thought it'd be an interesting idea. What do you think management said? No way, Jose. The owners rejected this idea. They felt that getting into the beverage business would distract them from their primary focus of selling coffee beans. To them, coffee was something to be prepared in the home. They did give away little free samples of pre-made drinks for people to taste, but that wasn't their business. Schultz was pretty sure there might be a market in the U.S. for pre-made coffee drinks. So he started Il Giornale, a coffee bar chain, in April of 86. In 1987, after he'd already started this chain, the original Starbucks management decided to focus on Peet's coffee and tea, so they sold the Starbucks retail unit to Schultz for $3.8 million. It's worth about $26 billion today, so he made a good investment. He rebranded Il Giornale with the Starbucks name and aggressively expanded the Starbucks reach across the United States as he managed this new, to him, brand. Starting from 17 Seattle-based stores in 87, Schultz expanded rapidly into other cities, Vancouver, Portland, and Chicago. By 91, Starbucks had also expanded into the mail order catalog business and licensed airport stores, and they expanded further in the state of California. By 1992, Starbucks had grown to 165 outlets. Manage, manage, manage. The first international location for Starbucks was in Tokyo in 1996. Currently, Starbucks is present in more than 80 countries with more than 35,700 worldwide stores, including about 15,800 in the U.S. I digress from testable material to tell a true story about how hard it is to see the future. So I mentioned before I used to take students internationally for quite a while. One of the places we took them was to Paris. So we're hearing about Starbucks wanting to enter France. And the French have these cafes where they drink really terrible coffee, and they'll sit there watching the world go by sipping this horrendous coffee. However, they really liked it, their whole sort of world of watching the world by. So my colleague at the time, Mike Mayo, and I looked at each other and said, Starbucks is never going to catch on in Paris. It's just not going to happen. The next time I went to Paris, in the Louvre, their national museum, the coffee shop in the museum was Starbucks. Starbucks is everywhere in Paris now. It's hard to foresee how these things will play out. Schultz had the idea. So he managed the product and the brand extensions. In the early 90s, he used the internet to offer people the option to purchase Starbucks coffee online. Another product he came out in 2009 was offered online for Via. I'll return to that in a moment. In 95, they offered Starbucks coffee on United Airlines flights. In 95, they produced premium coffee ice cream with Dreyer's, a little brand partnership. Both brands are respected. 97, introduced Starbucks Barista Home Espresso Machine, featuring a new portafiller system that accommodated both ground coffee and Starbucks' new ready-to-use espresso pods. 98 offered chai tea latte, a combination of black tea and exotic spices, honey and milk, 98 distributed whole bean and ground coffee to supermarkets. This guy knows how to manage a brand. 99 sold premium teens through Starbucks-owned Tazo Tea Company. 2005, they sold CDs in Starbucks retail stores because in 99 they had purchased Hear Music as a record label and music marketer. 2008, they started a community website, My Starbucks Idea, to collect suggestions and feedback from customers. 2008, they introduced a loyalty program for their customers. 2009, they introduced a new line of instant coffee packets called Via Ready Brew. Tear it open, dump it in, add water. Anybody try Via? Has anybody tried that product? Yeah? No? You would just, yes? Don't like it? No, she's up there. She's behind you. She doesn't, didn't like it at all. They think it tastes just like Starbucks. You and I agree. In talking about Via, CEO Howard Schultz says that the instant coffee won't tarnish Starbucks' premium image. Nah. For less than $1 a cup, people can have a cup of coffee that's a mirror image of Starbucks. Not all consumers agree with that. 2010, they expanded further into mass market with lower-priced coffee brands to help it compete with alternatives offered by players like McDonald's. They came up with Seattle's Best. Through Seattle's Best, a lower-priced brand, they can sell cheaper coffee without cheapening the Starbucks name. A little bit of brand management on the name. We're going to expand our product. Do we call it Starbucks Light, Starbucks Cheap, Starbucks for You? No. We're still making the product and profit, but we're calling it a different brand name. Now, not all brand ideas work out very well. In 2012, Starbucks paid about $620 million for Teavana, hoping to jumpstart the next wave of growth in this dynamic tea category. They bought the Teavana brand. They brought it into Starbucks locations. They held on to Teavana's own retail stores. They even opened a few high-end Teavana fine teas, tea bars. Anybody see one of those up at Beechwood Mall a while ago? They had a, yeah, that, oh, you're a Starbucks fan, Via. Okay, so it was there for a while, it was gone. But the business wasn't doing well enough for Starbucks to keep it going. In July 2017, Starbucks announced plans to shut all 379 Teavana stores down over the coming year, with the majority of Teavana-only stores set to close by spring of 2018. They're gone. In 2016, they worked on single-serving pods. So in addition to inking a new agreement with Keurig Green Mountain, Inc. to sell K-Cups in more channels in North America, again in 2012 in Walmart stores, Starbucks plans to launch branded pods for Nestle's Nespresso machine in international markets in 2106. They're really getting ahead of the curve. That might have been 2016. And Nestle's Nespresso machines are really big in Europe. The logo, managing the image of the product. So it's achieved broad visual recognition, but it isn't what it started as. So the original logo from 71 to 87 was fashioned after a 15th century Norse woodcut. The image of a mythical two-tailed mermaid siren was on it. With a coffee brown color scheme, the circular ring surrounded the mythological mermaid figure contained the text Starbucks, coffee, teas, spices. The overall image was designed to resemble a cigar band label. The symbolism of the mermaid siren was intended to suggest the irresistible and seductive quality of the coffee itself. I'm a little amused. Does anybody know the mythological mermaids and what happened to sailors who were seduced by those mermaids? Does anybody know a little mythology? You do or you don't? Yeah? What happened to the sailors that were brought in by the music? The ship crashed and they downed and they killed them, etc. Yeah. So is that what you're going for? Oh, hold on. I'm going to run up there real quick because I need a little aerobics. So hold on. Here I go. Say what? One more time. They
sailors ended up dying.
Exactly right. They missed that little bit of it when they were talking about the seductive nature of the mermaids, but we'll ignore that part for now. All right, so that was the original logo. When Howard Schultz purchased Starbucks in 87, the Starbucks logo was cleaned up a little bit. They made it a little more befitting a new corporate image because he owned it. The color scheme was changed from coffee brown, the original logo, to the green that he had created for his Il Giornale coffee brand. The text in the circular brand was changed just to Starbucks coffee. The third revision of the Starbucks logo in 92 crops the image of the mermaid with a close-up view. The mermaid's tails on either side are mostly obscured. And so people who had not followed all this change were wondering exactly what that was. What are those things? If you didn't know the earlier logo. In 2011, for its 40th anniversary, Starbucks debuted the most recent logo, which brings the iconic mermaid out of the circle and drops the words Starbucks Coffee. Huh. You've removed your brand name from your brand logo. Interesting. CEO Howard Schultz said, it embraces and respects our heritage. At the same time, it evolves us to a point that we feel it's more suitable for the future. The fact that it's no longer tied to the English language, Starbucks, makes it more marketable on an international level, And by the way, as a little teeny icon on your phone, you aren't really going to see all that print. Here it still works as a small icon on your smartphone. Starbucks competition. Anytime you're doing well in the marketplace, somebody's going to say, I can't believe he's making that much money doing that. I need a piece of that action. And that happened here too, as well. So 2007, customer traffic declined for the first time since the company went public, sending the stock tumbling. In 2008, the first great recession, Starbucks found itself in an economic climate that had most people reassessing their daily spending habits on luxury items. Company's revenues and profits tumbled. Starbucks was hurt by rising costs, cannibalizing effects of years of overexpansion, and stiff competition in the espresso drinks from the likes of McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts. By the end of 2008, Starbucks stock, when seemingly invincible, had declined by, ouch, over 50%. Competition has reared its ugly head, Starbucks. In January 2008, Starbucks threw out its then chief executive, James L. Donald, and brought back Schultz to try and invigorate the company. Schultz laid off 1,000 employees, closed 600 underperforming locations in the U.S., scaled back the rate of store openings domestically. At the same time, they moved aggressively to open stores overseas where business remained robust. It also introduced a new discount programs like the $25 gold card, offering 10% off on all items. The strategy sparked a comeback. Schultz knows how to manage a brand. For the coffee powerhouse, in 2010, Starbucks' profit was $948 million, and in 2011, it was up over 14% to $1.7 billion. Nice work. Continuing with the competition, in 2008, McDonald's announced that they'll take on Starbucks, installing coffee bars complete with baristas in its 14,000 U.S. locations. Some of you guys have seen coffee at McDonald's. No one's seen coffee at McDonald's. How many have seen a barista at any McDonald's? I don't think that idea went anywhere. That didn't work. But certainly their coffee special drinks happened. McDonald's and Starbucks had two different customer bases until McCafe was born in McDonald's and specialty coffee married fast food. For the most part, the customer bases are still far apart, but it's in the middle ground where customers could go either to Starbucks or to McDonald's where the war is focused. It's been easier for McCafe to hone in on specialty coffee than it is for Starbucks to compete in the fast food arena. At the time, most Starbucks outlets did not have kitchens, so the food was mostly wrapped sandwiches, pastries. Slowly, the company rolled out ovens, so at least some of the food items can be warmed up to serve hot. Down what is now the Cleveland Bagel Place, that was a Starbucks for a while, and I can remember them not having any warm food at all, and suddenly the first time they had an oven in there, the kind that they still have now, rolling out this idea across their companies to compete with McDonald's warm foods. Dunkin' fans? I like Dunkin'. Dunkin' fans. 2011, America runs on Dunkin', the tagline for the ever-popular Canton-based, not Canton, Ohio, Canton, somewhere in the New England. Coffee chain can soon be interpreted more literally, as this morning's IPO of Dunkin' Brands Group looks to raise over $400 million. The money will be used in part to build out the brand beyond its northeastern stronghold, where they will look to compete with the likes of McDonald's and Starbucks Corporation. 2011, The recession was considered a hamburger and beer consumption period. The proof of that may be the success of McDonald's sales. 2007, 8, and 9, they did well both in the US and overseas. And analysts attributed that to the fact that the fast food company decided to keep prices low and add a line of coffee drinks to compete with Starbucks. McDonald's is clever enough, duh, to price the coffee products below those of Starbucks customers. Gee, here's our target market, there's their target market. Should we charge as much for our coffee as they do for theirs? No, probably not. Let's charge it a little cheaper. McDonald's plan, which was copied by Dunkin', was created with taking market share from Starbucks. The twin problems of the recession and McDonald's success caused Starbucks to fire 12,000 people, close hundreds of stores. So competition continued going on. 2012, they bet consumers will get so tired of overpaying for Starbucks lattes, they'll be willing to slum it a bit on something just as frothy, but for a lot less money. They started to shift their focus from food to pricey beverages because that's where revenues are. In fact, it's to the point where Starbucks had either better start viewing the fast food chain as a serious rival or suffer the consequences. For summer 2012, McDonald's introduced the McCafe Cherry Berry Chiller, $2.89 for a 16-ounce cup, and the McCafe Frappe Chocolate Chip, $3.99 for a 6-ounce cup. Starbucks Frappuccino was $5.45 for a 16-ounce cup. But some say these iced blended drinks are still a lot for a fast food restaurant, but they've been doing okay. Anybody ever try any of these chillers at McDonald's? Not sure. Yeah, one guy. The point, in 2022 overall, Starbucks grew global revenues to a record $32.3 billion, a 13% gain over last year. U.S. net revenues were up 15% year over year to $6.1 billion. And how did they do that? Schultz and company managed the brand over time to improve their situation. Changing consumer tastes and competition require marketers to actively and successfully manage their products and their brands, or they become irrelevant. They go out of business. So it's important for us to talk about managing products and services, yeah? We say that virtually all products, all services go through something called the product life cycle, an important concept in marketing and in business in general. Obviously, products have to be developed. We just talked about how long it can take to develop a product and how expensive that can be. When you're developing a product, how much money are you making off the product? Nothing. In fact, since you're spending a lot of money developing, you're losing money hand over fist. And the longer you get into it, the more you're losing. Hope you got something planned for success. So, we see the product development stage, we see the profit line is the bottom green line, and we see it's not going very well while we're developing the product, because we're not selling anything yet. Then, we introduce the product. Let's see what clicks I got here. We introduce the product. We're still losing money. Why? There's not a huge amount of sales. We're ramping up that inventory. We're training that sales force. We're running that promotion to let people know what the product is and where to get it. It's cost us more and more money to get this going. Sales are growing just at the start. So this curve, the top green curve that humps up and then goes down, shows the aggregate demand over an extended period of time for all brands in a generic product category. So it's the whole industry looks like that. Your company might have come in and failed right away. You're gone. Your company may stand some chance of succeeding after the industry in general has gone into decline. So the product life cycle and the product curves vary from product category to product category. But this basic shape, slow growth, rapid growth, peak, fall off, is what we often see in many, many brand and service situations. So, as I was just saying, in the early stages, your profits are negative. Another word for negative profits, loss. You're losing money. So sales are needed to offset the product development costs. You better get going. You better start getting some success in here. So we begin to grow, we're catching on, things are going good. What did I just get done telling you is going to happen as soon as you're successful? Competition's going to rear its ugly head. They're going to want a part of whatever you're succeeding with. So as we grow, we've got to increase advertising and selling efforts and cut prices because in that growth into maturity stage, competition is rearing its ugly head. They want a piece of the action. So profits peak and then begin to decline. And of course, as sales eventually decline, your profits go down as well. When do you want to enter a market? Are you going to be the market leader, the market innovator? Are you going to come out first? Any risk in that? Could be. Are you going to hang back and wait to see how others do? Maybe they become a market leader. Could be hard for you to get in because they're already out there. They're already leading. When are you going to choose to enter the market can impact your profitability? Let's take a look at digital cameras. Who remembers having a digital camera at home? Parents had a digital camera. It was a big thing in the day. 1981, Sony launches the Makiva in anticipation of the arrival of magnetic recording still camera era. Canon formed a task force to develop a magnetic recording color still camera. 1981, we're developing this new concept. Not film, but digital. First commercially marketed still video camera, digital camera, came out in 86. Brand new technology, exciting new stuff. What's the price for this new product that's going to roll out, new to the world, very exciting? $2,500. New products rolling out often appeal to a very small select people, a group of innovators who are willing to pay that high price to be the first on their block to have that new technology. They're really excited about it. Apple quickly got in on the action. They saw what was going on with the QuickTake. Apple QuickTake 100 launched in 94. It was actually manufactured by Kodak, who didn't have great faith in digital cameras in the future. It was the first color digital camera for under $1,000. It packed a whopping 640 by 480 pixels CCD and could stash as many as 8 images in its internal memory. Holy mackerel, 8 pictures. Can you imagine? For less than $1,000. The Casio QV10 was new in 96. It was the first with an LCD screen on the back. You can see products are improving to compete. Other now familiar features included macro positioning, automatic exposure, auto playback of images. It still cost about $1,000, but we were improving our products to compete in the marketplace. Smart media card and compact flash cards arrived in 96. The first camera to use the compact flash was Kodak's DC25. It was only $500. The Canon PowerShot G1 released in 2000. It listed at Best Buy for $800 in 2021. In 2000, the first, oh dear, camera phones were introduced. By 2003, camera phone sales exceeded the sales of digital cameras. Technology moved on, consumer tastes move on. There's a small segment that still likes it. Anyone still use a digital camera at home or for business? Yeah, I still like it. It still has a quality. All the rest of us are using our smartphones, thank you. But there's a small niche that still wants that sort of product. So growth, decline. Digital camera sales dropped 84% since 2010. Cameras with built-in lenses, cameras with interchangeable lenses, grow, and crash down. As consumer tastes change, Apple phone was released in 2007, iPhone 4S in 2011, and so on. Ooch, there it goes. We're just overselling this, I guess, what smartphones have done to the camera industry. Worldwide shipments of photo cameras were going pretty good until the product came out. So you see product life cycle at work. What about a new product rolling out, electric vehicles? We've been talking about them, but they're still new.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Ford Motor Company said today it figures it's going to lose about $3 billion this year on its electric vehicle business. The company started selling its first electric car in this country in 2020. It says it expects its EV business to start turning a profit by 2026. Marketplace Samantha Fields reports on the internal combustion to electric transition.
Launching one new car, even just a new gas-powered one, is always expensive for automakers.
Because they get knocked off their efficiencies of producing.
Tyson Jomini at J.D. Power says the auto industry is all about efficiency. Churning out a whole lot of the same car or similar ones is key to how companies make money.
Like Henry Ford said, you can get any Model T you want so long as it's black. You know, that was done for efficiency reasons, right?
So launching a whole new division to make a whole new kind of car, kind of a bumpy ride.
You have to think about Ford Model E, that EV business, effectively as a startup within Ford.
T.R. Reid, a spokesperson for Ford, says making gas-powered cars and making EVs
is significantly different.
For all traditional car makers, getting into the electric vehicle market requires massive investment, says Michelle Krebs at Cox Automotive.
It's all new. They're teaching workers how to build these. They're building new plants. That's a huge part of the expense. Every automaker is building new assembly plants, new battery production plants, and those aren't cheap.
The time that it's taking to make this transition and get customers on board is also costing automakers money, says Jessica Transic at MIT.
Really understanding what consumers are looking for and building up momentum on the demand side.
Right now, just 6% of cars being sold are electric, so there's a long way to go. Transic says this is all just part of the process of making something new. It's not unique to electric cars.
In general, when we look at really the development of any technology, what you see is that it typically requires an upfront investment in research and development.
That, she says, tends to pay off many times over down the line. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
If the product is successful, so I trust you see exactly what we've been talking about, the difficulty of introducing new products, the costliness in product development, the hope that things go success, the need to educate consumers about whatever it is going on, your channel partners, your manufacturing staff, how things are working. So all things we've been talking about at work here in the EV market today. So let's think a little bit about these characteristics of the product life cycle and what it implies for us. In the introduction stage, who's going to pay $2,400 for a new camera? Innovators. People who really are excited by this new thing. Anybody in your neighborhood already have an EV, electric vehicles? Any of your folks have an EV? Yeah? Are they at all innovators? Would that describe them? Excited about the new technology? They know the price is going to drop down over time. They don't care. They want it now. Innovators. Competition, little, if any, depending how unique you are with your new product. Sales are low. Hopefully, they're beginning to slowly rise, right? And at this stage, you probably aren't making any profits. As Ford said, they're losing, what did they say, $3 billion right now? Whoops. All right. So, what are we trying to do here at this stage? People don't understand whatever this new thing is, this new product or service. So we're trying to develop the market overall. Costs are high per unit. Why? We don't have long production runs of the same thing. People don't know what's going on. We haven't gotten into mass purchasing of parts. People keep making mistakes on the line because it's all new and things have to be redone. So it's expensive on a per unit basis. The product strategy is often undifferentiated. We just want people to buy the product category, and then us. Pricing strategy, most likely high. Boy, we would like to recover some of those product development costs. Distribution is scattered. Channel members don't know if they want to carry the thing or not. And the promotional strategy is often category awareness. Hey, this is what this thing is. You got to consider it. All right, we're successful enough. We don't fall off the map right away. Oh, yeah. So here's my example. I think this is still teeny but growing. How many of you guys have a 3D printer at home? I thought we saw some hands last time. So, you know, a little bit in each class, maybe we'll see more people having it. I don't know if you paid that much, but initially they were pretty expensive. There's one for $3,500, $2,800, there's $1,250. You're shaking your head. No, did you get a cheap one? You have two. How much did you pay for those? Oh, used, you're cheating. All right, how about the other way? all right, so we're stimulating demand for the entire product category rather than for a single brand is typically what happens early on in the product life cycle. Growth, hey, it's catching on, yay. So we're beginning now no longer to have to sell to just the innovators. More of the mass market folks are interested in the product. Now, since you're beginning to be successful, what's going to happen? What I tell you all the time, as soon as you're beginning to be successful, competition is going to start rearing its ugly head, getting involved. So competition is beginning to increase. Because it's the growth stage, sales are growing. And profits, yay, are beginning to grow. They're going to peak, because pretty soon we have to start fighting off competition. Rats, we were just making money. Now we're losing. Yeah. Overall strategy, we're trying to penetrate into this market that we've built up. Costs, per unit costs are declining. Why? Because the longer production runs you have, you get economies of scale, you're not making mistakes. We have reduced per unit costs. Product strategy, now we're starting to improve features, come up with new things to differentiate ourselves from competition. Product strategy, pricing strategy, it was really, really high. Now, the per unit cost is beginning to drop, so we can reduce our price. Second, competition is beginning to rear its ugly head. We've got to reduce our cost or our price. So pricing strategies begin to get lower over time. Distribution strategy moves from scant, hardly anywhere, to intensive. The mass market wants our product. And now we're no longer concerned about just convincing people about the product category. We want to build brand preference for us over that competition. As profits fall, we need more resources to attract customers away from other offers. So if we're part of a big company with a lot of product lines, we have to fight for our resources to keep going. Maturity. We've been out there for a long time. People know who we are. The mass market is buying us. And because we've been successful, competition is no longer just there. It's intense. Sales, again, we're mature, so sales are not really growing, and maybe they're actually beginning to decline a little bit at the peak. And profits are beginning to decline every year. We're fighting off competition. Our prices are declining. So we have to have a defensive position in the marketplace against competition. Our costs are stable, or maybe they're beginning to increase. We have to come up with new product features. We have to come up with new colors, new sizes, new flavors. So our per unit cost begins to increase. Product strategy is certainly differentiation from the competition. Pricing strategy is going to eventually become the lowest that we're going to have. Our distribution strategy is still intensive. And our promotional strategy is, hey, you know us. We've been here. You've been with us. Stay loyal to us. Don't go with that nasty competition. And here's what we're offering you. Better price, better product, better, more flavors. Firms attempt to differentiate themselves from competition in this maturity stage. The decline. Why do products and services decline? Well, first, because brands, companies come out with less expensive products that meet the same need. Second, because the need for the product itself disappears over time, changing norms, changing consumer values. How many of you guys sat on the front porch playing board games when you were kids? How many of you guys sat in the downstairs room and played games on your computer when you were kids? Okay. Of course, there were no computers when I was growing up. We all sat on the front porch playing board games. Now I think you can get the board games on the computer. So we're seeing a change. It's not entirely gone, but certainly it's in decline, right? So here kids are playing video games over board games. Things change. Who recognizes that thing on the left? What is that? What is it? On the left? Nobody knows what it is. You're just not going to yell it out. It's a juicer. In the day, man, everybody had a juicer. You got your orange. You squeezed it on the juicer to produce fruit juice for your morning, for your orange juice or whatever, right? That is not as common as it once was. Now, on the right, you see a fancy version of that for people that are really into technology. They want a little innovation there. But fresh squeezed orange juice used to be the only way to get it. Then we invented something different, frozen orange juice. Does anybody remember the frozen orange juice in this can? You would take it out, it would glop out, and it would still be this gloppy mess. And then you had to just pour in water and stir it up, and stir it up, and stir it up. Somehow that was more convenient than squeezing it yourself. Then it mostly went away. Why? It was replaced by the pre-made stuff, refrigerator stable in the box there. Things change over time. So, who are you selling to in the decline stage? Truly loyal customers. There's some folks out there that still like the idea of squeezing their own oranges manually on one of those little things. Not a lot, but some. Competition is throwing their hands up. There's not a lot of money to be made here. There's not a lot of growth. I'm getting out. Sales are declining. It is the decline stage of the product life cycle. And your profits are pretty, pretty low, pretty marginal. You're not making a lot of money. Your strategy is either to get really efficient. You're not coming up with new shapes, new sizes, new flavors. You're trying to get long runs of the same thing. Your costs compared to what they were, because you aren't fighting off competition, and you really know how to make the thing, are low. Product strategy, prune your lines down just to satisfy those loyal customers. At this point, you may actually begin to increase your price over what it was when you were fighting off competition. You're one of the few people still out there, and there are consumers who really still want your hand squeezer, so you can raise your price a little bit. Distribution strategy is selective. You aren't going to carry a whole inventory to put it in every store. People don't want it. And your promotional strategy is reinforcement. You remember who we are. You remember what we are. You liked us. Buy more of us. Most competitors say, meh, I'm done with that. I'm out. I'm doing something else. Some can develop a small, successful niche. This next example was a company who, in essence, went out of business, but somebody else picked them up because they thought they'd be cute. Pink flamingos. Who's seen pink flamingos in the front yard somewhere celebrating a birthday or whatever? That company went bust. Somebody said, no, we've got to have it. They bought it, and you can still find a small number of pink flamingos in front yards throughout the country. What's that on the left-hand side up there? Is it, well, not on the left. What's the one on the left? No? It's a version of a classic pot-bellied stove. In the old days, before we had home heating, you had cabins, and the way you heated your cabin and cooked your meals was on a nice old pot-bellied stove. There's not a lot of demand for pot-bellied stoves today, yeah? Either to heat your home or to cook. But what have they done? They have indeed created a more modern version that's decorator. You can still technically cook on it, I guess, but it's mostly decoration and not really for heating the whole house. Anybody have a nice decorated version of one of these at home? So they created a new version of the product to satisfy, but it's not a huge growth market for them. So you can see a little niche out there for this sort of product. The product life cycle diagram that I showed you sort of suggested that the stages were of equal length, equal time period. I just drew lines there, right? But in fact, that's not really accurate. And certainly, the amount of time from the introduction to the decline can vary quite a bit. So we have to be aware of those differences. Think about fashion. Would you say, compared to other industries and other brands, other products, is fashion items got a relatively short or a relatively long product life cycle, would you say? Short, right? In and out in usually a season. You're here, you're gone. Compare the product life cycle for fashion to the product life cycle for playing cards. Anybody know what a playing card is? Anybody have playing cards? Anybody still using playing cards? How long have playing cards been around? A long time. So the length of the product life cycle can vary quite a bit. Why is that highlighted? I did something and I'm not sure what I did. 38 unforgettable 2000 fashion trends that are making a comeback. I should be careful what I'm scrolling on here. Graphic tees, shoulder bags, micro mini skirts. All right, never mind. We also have the opposite thereof, which is an extended product life cycle, especially in that introduction stage in marketing. We often find that it takes a good long time before a product begins to get into that growth stage. Why? I've got to convince people about what this product is. They got to know what it is. They got to know where to be able to buy it. I ought to convince my channel members it's worth carrying. What do you mean you want me to give up shelf space for that product? So it can take a good long time for the product to take off. An extended introduction stage was the microwave oven. In 1947, the first commercial microwave oven hit the market. It was a primitive unit. It was gigantic. It was expensive. It was 5.5 feet tall. It weighed over 750 pounds. It cost $5,000 each in 1947 dollars. The magnetron tube had to be water cooled, so you needed a plumbing installation. You can see why that didn't catch on right away. It wasn't until 1975 that sales of microwave ovens for the first time exceeded that of gas ranges, 28 years after their introduction. And microwave-safe trays for TV dinners weren't around before 1986. In the old days, TV dinners, anybody know what they were made out of? Never saw one that old? Aluminum. So they came in an aluminum tray. You ever put an aluminum tray in a microwave oven? Whoa, you want a fire? Try that out for size. So you had to, you couldn't just take your TV dinners and put them in a microwave until 1986. So it did take a while for them to succeed. On the other hand, fads happen. Gingham style, you guys remember Gingham style? Gingham style, you remember Gingham style? Yeah, Gangnam style, song released in 2012 by South Korean musician Psy, became the first YouTube video ever to reach a billion views and ignited a worldwide dance craze. A worldwide dance craze.
Oppa Gangnam Style. Oppa Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
Etc. A billion views of that silliness. Who's doing Gangnam Style today? Nada. Nobody. It's not a thing, right? It walks, it talks, it grabs stuff, it throws stuff. Robo sapien. Heck, it can even do kung fu. Never heard of it? Well, that's because after its 2004 heyday saw 2 million units sold, the Robo sapien took a nosedive. That product life cycle, as you can see there, pretty much a fad. In, massive sales out. I don't know, what do we remember? Beanie Babies? Do we remember those? Or is that too much before our time? Yeah? Man, Beanie Babies in the day were the bomb. I mean, and they got really expensive. You could get them in a plastic case with a mink coat for who knows how much money. Not a big thing today. Pogs, anybody remember Pogs? Yeah, you remember Pogs? Can you say real quick what a Pog was and explain its massive appeal to an audience? Little cardboard disc, little picture, collected, and also though you could, depending on your school, they caused major problems, stack them up, throw things against them. If it fell outside the circle, you would have to give it away, like the old thing of marbles. Schools had to ban them. They were so popular in the day. How's your Pog collection today? Not really a thing. Came and went. What are those things? Silly bands. How many of you had silly bands when you were little? How many of you still are collecting silly bands? Well, some of you still are. Okay, that's fine. Don't worry about it. So they're still around, but not as hugely popular as they were. Pokemon Go. Who's still doing Pokemon Go? Somebody here. Yeah, one, two, three. Hey, you got some. Oh, got some. Okay, I see I'm almost out of time. All right, I guess I am out of time. I'm sorry. We'll pick up next time. I was just getting excited about fads. Sorry.